Today we're talking with Jason Cohn, the co-director and writer of the documentary film Eames, The Architect and the Painter. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Jason, tell us a little about your background and the role you played in making this film.
Well, my background is that of a generalist. I'm not a design historian or even really a design aficionado, really. I mean, I like design, but I didn't know a lot about it before I started this. I'm a journalist, and I've done a lot of different kinds of reporting in different media and different subject matter, from politics to culture, technology, lots of different things. But I just, you know, somewhat randomly became interested in mid-century design, and through that started reading about Charles and Ray Eames, and I thought, wow, you know, these people are really fascinating, and it doesn't appear that anybody's ever really made a documentary about them, a full-length documentary for PBS. So I, you know, approached the family to see if they'd let us do it, and they agreed, and the rest was 7 years of hard work, 6 or 7 years of hard work.
Oh, wow. What was your role, or what was your experience as a filmmaker before this documentary?
Well, I had worked on a lot of documentaries, you know, mostly for PBS, but also for National Geographic and some other programs. But they were generally other people's films. So I would get hired as a writer or as a field producer. But I had never really sort of planted a seed and then nurtured it all the way myself as a producer director. So this was my first chance to do that.
And has it been a success?
Yeah, it's been really kind of surprising. Because when we made the film, we thought, you know, we were going to make this for television, and we knew that we were going to get it on American Masters, which is a really good place mm-hmm. to be on PBS. It has national, you know, it's in every major market, and it's prime time and all of that. And we knew that it would be seen by a lot of people, but we didn't know that it was going to be in, you know, theaters all over the country, and internationally. We're getting a lot of success internationally as well. So it's really, it's being seen by way more people than we ever thought it would be.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
How hard was it to get the funding to do this?
It was murder.
How do you go about that?
Well, first of all, you know, the economy had a little bit of a bump in the middle of our fundraising. There was that little sort of Great Recession thing that happened. Mm-hmm. So the early years, when we first started raising money for this film, it wasn't that bad. Because when you're asking for sort of smaller amounts of money and the economy is booming, we actually people recognized that there was a lot of value in this film, and people wanted to, there were a lot of people who wanted to be attached to the story of Charles and Ray Eames because it's a very attractive story. But then when we started asking for a lot of money, which is what it, you know, takes to make a good documentary like this, and the economies crashed, then all of a sudden it became very hard. So we went through a 2 or 3 period where it was just a bit of a slog.
When you're making a film, how much time do you actually spend filming and how much time do you spend researching?
Well, I think it really depends on the film. I kind of tend to do projects that are more research-oriented. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to start doing more of the other kind where it's more like, oh, I just met this incredible person who's doing, you know, these amazing things, and I'm just going to go with my camera and follow them around for a couple months and see what happens. Where it doesn't really require a lot of research or a deep understanding of the subject matter before you go in. It's just sort of being, you know, putting in the hours to follow something that's unfolding in front of your camera. And I've never really made that kind of a film, but it really appeals to me, the idea of doing that kind of a film. I've tended to do films that were more historical in nature or investigative in nature, and those tend to be really research-based, research-oriented. And then in that case, you know, in this case, it was probably like a 3-to-1 research to production ratio in terms of the amount of time I actually put in.
Did you get a lot of help from the Eames family?
Well, they gave us access to everything in the Eames archive, which is this, you know, really unparalleled archive of visual material. It's at the Library of Congress. It's, you know, something like 1 million items, mostly photographics, slides, and prints. Documents, too, but not nearly as many. It's really, you know, photography. And also hundreds of reels of film that the Eames has made. So they gave us access to that, and that was everything. Like, without that, there's no way to make this film. And then the family was very, you know, they were very genial with us and open with us, and they agreed to, you know, the the daughter of Charles Eames, whose name is Lucia, she agreed to go on camera, and the grandson of Charles Eames, whose name is Eames Demetrios, he went on camera. So they've been lovely throughout.
I think what's intriguing is when I read your bio that you watched a DVD series and you became very intrigued with them. What was the greatest lesson, or actually, what did you learn about the Eames that was very intriguing to you as you went through this process?
Yeah, so the Eames office, which is run by the Eames family, put out a DVD set. I think it's 6 volumes of the films of Charles Henry Eames. And it's not all of the films by any means, but it's a sort of a curated set of films. And it includes some of the most famous ones, like Powers of Ten and Toccata for Toy Trains and Tops and films like that. So that was basically handed to me by a friend who was a cinemaphile and had come across these films, and they're kind of obscure, but they're also, they have a kind of cachet within this community of cinemaphiles who, you know, kind of go looking for weird, geeky, you know, movie stuff that the average person wouldn't see. And so, you know, I got a hold of these and I spent a night watching a bunch of these films, and, you know, it just made this huge impression on me. And this was way before I knew anything about their furniture or knew anything about them. And it was way before I had the idea to make the film too. But I think what struck me about the films is just how sui generis they are, you know, that they don't fit into any genre that you normally, you know, go looking for with a film. They're not narrative films, and they're not, some of them are sponsored films, so they're sort of, you know, a little bit of that corny, you know, corporate video kind of thing, but from the 1950s, so they have a certain charm. Mm-hmm. But mostly they're just films that are about ideas that for some reason or another struck the fancy of Charles and Ray Eames, and they just wanted to explore the idea visually, like the idea of tops, the idea of tops spinning, and how they're different and similar in all of these cultures, Japanese tops and Russian tops and Mexican tops and French tops. And they're just filmed, you know, it's filmed and edited so beautifully. And I guess what stuck with me is a lot of the images obviously stuck with me because they were so gorgeous. But then the other thing that stuck with me was just this image of, you know, behind these films, there had to be these people making them. And I wanted to know, you know, who are these people that in the 1950s, this sort of conformist era, were making these strange little films, you know, that were based completely on their whims. So it just made me think, what kind of a life do you have to live to be able to do that? You know, how do you get to be the people that have a studio where they make these films about, you know, the scale of the universe and toy trains moving through an imaginary landscape and tops spinning? So I think that's what stuck with me, and that's what made me curious to know more about who these people were. And then the more that I found out about them, I realized that really is sort of the secret to who they were, is that they were driven by their curiosity and not by, you know, the things that the rest of us are usually driven by, like the profit motive and those kind of things. They really did the things that, they answered the questions that they wanted to answer.
What do you think their personalities were like in terms, did you get some dialogue with people that had worked with them and talked about their work and working in their office?
Yeah, we made the decision fairly early on that we were going to build the film largely around recollections of people who worked with them, because they were working people. They weren't socialites. They didn't go to parties. They didn't go out to dinner very much. What they did was they worked. They got up in the morning, they went to the office, and they worked until late at night. And then they went home, and they would usually work in their home studio making films and stuff like that until it was time to go to bed. So in a sense, the people who knew them best were the people who worked with them in that 24/7 environment. And so that's who we talked to, were people like Janine Opelwall and John Newhart and Deborah Sussman, Gordon Ashby, people who worked in the Eames office for many years and knew them in that context, the working context. So that's largely the sense that we got of them as personalities, was what they were like to be around in the office, what they were like to work for and work with. And it's a very complex question. You know, they were, first of all, they were very different. Charles and Ray were very different kinds of personalities. They were also very private. They didn't necessarily let people in very much to sort of their, you know, their inner life. But it's clear that they had a deep inner life, both of them. They were both enormously charming. That's clear. People who worked with them, they liked to work with younger people. And they developed an almost paternal and maternal kind of relationship with the young designers in their office. You know, maybe not loving exactly, but a very, I think, you know, this it almost goes back to that Greek idea of education, that they like to bring in people who are a little bit rough and unformed as designers and teach them through the process of really doing things, like in an apprenticeship type of way. And I think that the people who worked for them got an immaculate education through being around them.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How do you think the Eames chair became so famous?
Well, when you talk about the Eames chair, you could be talking about a lot of different chairs, but you're probably talking about the plywood one, which was sort of the first one that launched their career, and that was called the Plywood Group of Chairs. They have like these acronym names like LCW, which stands for lounge chair wood, or DCW, which stands for dining chair wood, or DCM, dining chair metal. But they're basically this sort of potato chip shaped plywood with different, either a wood base or a metal base. You know, Time magazine called it the design of the century, and it was this technologically very innovative piece of furniture. And it was innovative because they figured out how to, they were working with plywood, which at the time in the 40s and 50s was kind of space age material. Now it seems kind of dowdy, but it was like the mylar or carbon fiber of its time. You could shape it in different ways, and this was sort of before plastics, so that was kind of exciting to be able to do that. And they were able to make something that was really comfortable, but didn't require a lot of, you know, fluffy padding and upholstery. It was lightweight. You could move it around. It was beautiful because it was like a piece of sculpture, and it had this kind of, I don't want to say anthropomorphic, but organic shape to it. It looks a bit like an animal. It has like a spine with legs.
Right.
And you can look at it from any angle in a room. It could sit in the middle of a room. You don't have to push it against the wall. It can sit in the middle of the room in any angle that you look at it from. It's beautiful. It's a piece of sculpture. So it really, you know, it works as art, functional art that you can sit on. And it was affordable. I think when it debuted, it was selling for $24 or something like that for those chairs. So it was really a remarkable piece of furniture. And what it was doing was it was answering this need, which all of these modern designers were attempting to do, which was, how do you make something of extremely high quality that's aesthetically attractive that anybody could afford? That a guy who works at a factory or works in a shop can buy a nice dining table with these nice dining chairs. So this idea that you don't have to be fabulously rich to have nice things in your house or in your apartment. And Charles and Ray were kind of the first ones to really be able to do that at a mass level.
The irony is that aren't they really collectible items now?
Now they are, yeah. But for a long time they weren't, and people just threw them in the dumpster. The fiberglass chairs were made, you know, in the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions of units. And when they'd get a little bit scratched up or a little bit dirty or whatever, people would just toss them in the alley. And it wasn't until the 80s that people, late 80s, I think, that some people started saying, you know, I think that these might be worth something one day. And they started picking them up and restoring them. And then there was some guy in New York who did the first Eames vintage auction. And he did this while Ray was still alive. This is probably around, you know, 87 or something, right before she died. And she didn't approve. Because she felt that those things, the whole idea with these chairs was that they were supposed to hit, you know, a price point that anybody could afford. And the idea of them selling at vintage, you know, sort of fine art prices, chairs going for hundreds or thousands of dollars, was really deeply offensive to her. And it took a lot of convincing before she was willing to basically say that it was okay. But nowadays, yeah, you know, some of the, you know, like the storage units or some of the, you know, more difficult to find chairs or tables will go for tens of thousands of dollars. Sometimes, you know, even for like rare, like prototype things, even more than that.
Wow. Where did they grow up, Ray and Charles?
Well, Ray grew up in Sacramento, California. Mm-hmm. Charles grew up in St. Louis. And they met in Cranbrook, Michigan. Ray went to New York So she grew up in Sacramento. She moved to New York, kind of following around her brother, who was at West Point. And she studied with Hans Hofmann, who is he was a German emigre modern art teacher. And he's sort of the guy who taught a lot of the people who went on to form the great abstract expressionist movement in New York in the 1930s and 40s. So she was part of a real cutting edge avant-garde group in New York in the 1930s. But I think at some point she kind of hit the wall there. She did very good painting, and I think she was, you know, quite serious about it. But I don't know exactly what caused her to stop painting so much, but I think that she felt that she wanted to try something different, and somebody told her that she should check out Cranbrook, which was a place where they were doing really innovative design and architectural education. They're sort of combining lots of areas, like weaving and pottery and architecture and urban planning, basically the arts and industry. And she went there, and Charles had been teaching there for about a year, and that's where they met.
So how did you go from being, because your background is a journalist, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you get into filmmaking from being a writer?
Well, I don't think of myself as a filmmaker that much, to be honest. I mean, okay. It's just sort of the medium that I use, but I would be happy to go write a book too. But there is something that's really fun about making films. One is that it's very collaborative, so it's not as lonely as writing articles or writing books. And with this film, you know, I was working with an amazing team, my co-director, Bill Jersey, who is kind of a lion in the field of documentary film. He got his first Academy Award nomination 2 years before I was born. So he's turning 85 in June. He's made, I think, 40 or 50 films. He's an amazing guy, and I've learned a huge amount from him. And I was working with my wife on the film. She was a producer, and we had an incredible editor named Don Bernier, who's, you know, just his artistry, I think, really elevated this film. So I think that's part of why I have started doing more documentary rather than just being a freelance writer or something like that, because I really enjoy working with other people.
And how did you get Bill Jersey on board with you?
I had been working for Bill, actually. I was like a writer in his shop, basically. I was his writer for several years. He was one of the first people who gave me a break in documentary film. So I had worked with him on several projects in the past. And then at some point, you know, I didn't want to kind of work for him anymore, but I had this idea to do this film, and I asked Bill if he was interested in doing it with me. And yeah, so at some point I just decided, you know, that I didn't really want to work for Bill anymore, but I still wanted to work with him. You know, he's just a terrific guy. And so I had this idea of making the film about Charles Henry Eames, and I brought it to him, and he loved the idea. He actually had one of the big Eames leather lounge and ottoman chairs in his office. It was, you know, that's where he would take a nap every day.
Oh, cool.
And he didn't know much about them, but he's an artist himself, and I think that he had a sense that there might be something good in there. So, so we collaborated on that for many years.
How have you seen film and filmmaking change over the past few years that you've been involved?
So it's changing in so many ways. The technology is changing, which, you know, and sometimes is really good. The fact that we have these incredibly brilliant cameras that are super lightweight and actually pretty affordable, that can capture, you know, HD images better than, you know, these enormous expensive cameras of 10 years ago ever could, or 20 years ago. So that's good. People have an expectation that that's bringing our costs way down, but it doesn't really. It's still very expensive to make films. So you run up against, you know, from the fundraising perspective, you run up against the sort of misinformation that you can make films on the cheap now because the technology has changed things. And that's really not the case. For example, licensing of images and music is getting outrageously expensive. So even if you might be able to shave a little bit of your costs on the technology side, on the licensing side, it ends up costing way more than ever before. I think that the technology has also enabled a lot of new delivery options. You know, people are really watching films on iPads and, you know, even on phones and on their computers a lot, which is great. People are watching films on, you know, streaming on Netflix. So I think there's a lot of ways for people to see documentaries now, whereas before there was only a limited number of, there were a limited number of channels anyway, and not that much of that space was allotted for documentary. So there's a lot more ways for people to see documentaries now, and the internet allows people to go looking for the things that they're interested in, affinity groups, people go to blogs, and right. like our film has been written up on, I have no idea, but dozens and dozens of design blogs and film blogs. So people who have an interest in design or an interest in film are likely to come across some information about our film, and then it's really easy for them to click through to Netflix or whatever to buy the DVD or to, you know, to watch it on their iPad or to watch it at home. So that's all really good. I would say that another big thing that's changed is that people are really focusing now on impact with film. So it's not just that you make a film that's fun to watch for a little bit, you know, or that has entertainment value. People are really looking for films that are making a difference, that connect to a community or group of people who want to change something. And films are increasingly now just sort of a part of a broader campaign around an issue or around a problem. And I think that's actually a very positive development as well. So the filmmakers are increasingly, I think, sort of having to take responsibility for their ideas and what they're trying to say in their film and help become part of a solution in a way.
That is very interesting. Do you think that radio is going the same way?
Whew, I don't know. yeah, I don't know. It's not really my field.
Oh, okay. Because yeah. I noticed that you worked for NPR on your bio. So
I have done a lot of radio reporting, or I did a lot of radio reporting when mm-hmm. I was sort of before I was doing documentary. But I don't really have a sense of how, you know, the radio business, the public radio business works.
Right. What are you working on now? What's your next thing?
Well, you know, I'm happy to say that with the success of this film that, you know, people have actually started coming to me and asking if I'd be interested in doing stuff. So there's a couple of things that are starting to pop up that may or may not turn into, you know, my next film. But the one that I've been developing on my own is a much more political topic. It's probably a little bit closer to my heart than Charles and Ray Eames is, although I feel silly saying that because I've spent 6 years with the Charles and Ray Eames story and I, you know, fell in love with them. But I think just sort of looking at the course of my life, I've always been more interested in political issues than in just sort of purely cultural issues like, you know, like Eames and design. So this one deals with government and with taxation and with economic equality issues, but it's really built around a very narrow story. And the story is something that happened in California in 1978, which was a voter initiative, a ballot initiative, you know, in California. I don't know if you have that in Wyoming, but in California, if you get enough, if you write a law as a citizen or a lobbyist or whatever, if you write a law and you get enough signatures, you can get your bill on the ballot, and then if enough people vote for it, it becomes law. And this happened in 1978, and it radically restructured California's government, slashing taxes, and it had a kind of a contagion effect because, you know, California is just very influential, and when that happened, it made a big splash. The guy who wrote the bill, his name was Howard Jarvis, he's on the cover of Time magazine, and within a couple of years, there were sort of copycat laws in 30 or 40 states across the country. And then a couple years later, Ronald Reagan became president, largely touting the success that California had had in cutting taxes. I have, you know, real mixed feelings about what happened in 1978 with that law. I mean, I think that it was redress for a very serious grievance that people had about the cost of their property taxes, and people were losing their houses, their homes, because of very high property taxes, especially older people on fixed incomes. And there was an absolute need to solve that problem. The governor and the legislature were not solving the problem. They were actually quite incompetent about it. So the voters, the citizens, did sort of take the ball into their own hands. But I think it was, looking at it from the long term, it was a situation where the solution might have been worse than the initial problem, because now we're basically on the verge of bankruptcy in California, as are many state houses across the country. And we have a revenue problem.
Do you have a name for this yet?
Well, at the moment, I'm just calling it the Tax Revolt documentary. But because basically the idea is that this event in 1978, the passing of Prop 13, was the watershed that set off the tax revolt, which we've, you know, to be honest, we've basically been in for about 35 years now. We've been in a state of tax revolt in this country for about 35 years. It's very easy to cut taxes. It's almost impossible to raise taxes. So I'm calling it the Tax Revolt documentary, hoping that somebody gives me a better idea, a better name. So if anybody out there has an idea.
That is so interesting. Well, I wish you luck on that. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I mean, it's great to be here.